Nahum by Fred Pearce. Of Nahum, whose name means consolation or comforter, or of his place of birth, nothing is known. Though there is a Jewish tradition that he came from Galilee, his prophecy bears no date, but there are two indications which enable us to fix it at least within certain limits. From the allusion to Thebes as having already suffered judgment, it is clear that the prophet must have been writing sometime after 660 BC, when that Egyptian city was sacked by the Assyrian emperor Ashurbanipal on his second invasion of Egypt. On the other hand, though the fall of Nineveh is spoken of as certain and indeed imminent, it evidently has not yet occurred. And since Nineveh was finally destroyed in the combined attacks of Babylonians, Medians, and Scythians about 612 BC, we're confined to the period 660 to 612. But the gap may be narrowed a little, for it appears from Nahum's prophecy that Judah had suffered quite recently from an Assyrian assault. Now, in the historical record, the long reign of Manasseh from 697 to 642 is almost one long blank. But it is known that Ashurbanipal's brother, whom he had made king of Babylon, revolted against him about 648 BC. If, as seems probable, this rebellion against the hated Assyrian was a signal to the Palestinian powers to revolt also, and they were usually quick to take such an opportunity, and if Judah joined in the revolt, and it was quelled by an Assyrian expedition, that would explain how Manasseh came to be taken in chains to Babylon, as 2 Chronicles 33 tells us, and would explain also the allusion of Nahum to an Assyrian onslaught. Now, these suggestions are purely conjectural, but they have the effect of locating Nahum's prophecy rather more narrowly between 640 and 620 BC. In view of the fact that Assyria is spoken of as still powerful and feared, the earlier part of that period is the more likely. Some find evidence in Nahum's prophecy that he was actually living in Nineveh when he wrote. And the following points are urged in support of the idea. Nahum seems well acquainted with Nineveh and things Assyrian. He uses Assyrian words to denote certain officers, speaks of the brick-built walls and the river gates. He even refers to the mantelet, or the portable shelter for the soldiers manning the battering ram. The word is found on the monuments. He speaks of the temples and images and of the palace in the center of the city as the last refuge of the defenders. He is aware of the large crowd of merchants with vast stores of wealth, of the princes with their tiaras, of the marshals and nobles. And these details are depicted with such vividness as to suggest that the writer must have been an eyewitness. And while it cannot be proved that Nahum had seen Nineveh, it is a natural inference from the forcibleness of the language. On the other hand, his acquaintance and concern with Israel and Judah appear in chapter 1, verse 4, and from chapter 1, verse 13, to the second chapter at verse 3. Conditions in Judah are, however, not described in detail, and there is no reference to the sins of the people or to the need for repentance. And it has been conjectured that Nahum may have been a descendant of the captives removed from northern Israel in 720 BC on the sack of Samaria, or that he was carried to Babylon in company with Manasseh. But at these points, we cannot be certain. One thing is clear: the prophecy was a written composition from the first, not just a record of oral discourses. It is remarkably single-minded, for while the destruction of the kingdoms of the nations based on pride and military might and the establishment of the kingdom of the Lord are regarded as certain, the recognition found in other prophets that the Assyrian oppression had been due to Israel's sins, and that it would be followed by the Babylonian, and that Judah was in urgent need of repentance, is absent. As Assyria had filled the political horizon of the Middle East for nearly 150 years, so her destruction was to the prophet the greatest event of his time, and a striking vindication of the honor of Yahweh, whose name had been reproached by Sennacherib. And this time there is no possibility of repentance or of reprieve for the city of blood. The prophecy may be conveniently treated in the three sections formed by its chapters. And the first expresses the majesty of God in judgment and his goodness to his people. The second describes the overthrow of Nineveh, and the third consists of a reflective lamentation upon that overthrow. In chapter 1, then, Nahum's prophecy is first called a burden, that is, a threatened judgment of Nineveh, and then a vision, that is, a revelation of events yet to happen. Evidently, after the repentance effected by the preaching of Jonah, the Ninevites had fallen back again into their former sins. And though appointed by God as the means whereby he would chastise his people, the Assyrians had set out to uproot Israel and Judah in satisfaction of their own pride. Nahum's name means comforter, but not evidently for the Ninevites, only for the faithful of Israel who still waited for the day of the Lord. And the name of Yahweh occurs three times in verse 2, his titles rising in awesomeness. He is first jealous, that is, jealous of the reputation of his name among the peoples, and of the way in which his own people either honor or are a reproach to that name. In the case of Nineveh, a long series of wrongs causes him to be an avenger. In the law, the Lord had expressly forbidden his people to take revenge, for vengeance belongeth unto me, thus asserting his right and his will to deal with men according to their deeds. And of unrighteous Israel, he later said, shall not my soul be avenged on such a nation as this? Shall I not visit for these things? And as we take into account the numerous cases where the opposite is said of God, will he reserve his anger forever? He will not always chide, neither will he keep his anger forever. We perceive the necessity of keeping the exact situation in mind before judging of such sayings. Here it is a question of an unrighteous city, evidently beyond the possibility of redemption. The second verse repeats the declaration of his own character given by God to Moses. Slow to anger recalls the result of Jonah's message to Nineveh and is the same phrase as long-suffering in Exodus 34. He will not at all acquit the wicked, he will by no means clear the guilty of Exodus. And the whirlwind and the storm are the familiar figures of judgment, as in Psalm 18. His rebuking the sea and drying up the rivers are allusions to the crossing of the Red Sea and Jordan, the evident demonstrations of his power. The desolations of Bashan, Carmel, and Lebanon, celebrated for pastures, grapes, and cedars, are cited as evidences of the judgments of God upon his own people. Yet, despite the terror of his indignation, and that is a word almost only used of the wrath of God, when the mountains are shaken as by earthquake and his fury is poured out like fire as in the destruction of Sodom, yet it remains a great truth that Yahweh is good, full of mercy to those who trust in him. Them he knows, as he did Rahab in Jericho and Hezekiah in Jerusalem. And as the psalmist asserts, the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous. It is against this profound Old Testament background that we must read the New Testament declarations, I know my sheep, and the Lord knoweth them that are his. And by contrast, I never knew you. Having recited for the encouragement of the faithful the internal characteristics of the Lord, Nahum now comes more closely to his immediate subject. Though Nineveh is still only referred to as the place, the flood, both of the armies God would send against them, or the swelling rivers which passed through the city, by tradition one of the means whereby the city was taken, would drive the Ninevites into the darkness of death. For was it not Sennacherib who had reproached the Lord, defied the Holy One of Israel, by contemptuously inquiring how the Jews could expect him to deliver them from his power, since none of the gods of the surrounding countries had been able to do so? And thus did he imagine against the Lord. But though the Ninevites take refuge behind their defences like tangled thorns and drench themselves in their drink, yet they shall blaze like dry stubble. The wicked counsellor, literally a counsellor of impiety or Belial, is usually understood as a reference to Sennacherib, but there is no reason why it could not be an allusion to an Assyrian monarch nearer to Nahum's time, and to a particular historical event of which we have no precise information. The address, thus saith the Lord, in verse 12, suitably marks the fact that the following words are directed to Israel rather than to Assyria. Although the Assyrians are in full strength, that is many, and self-confident, that is quiet, yet they shall be mown down as grass and shall pass away, not through. They shall pass away. Israel's divinely imposed affliction shall come to an end, and it is said that the verb afflict, when used of the action of God, applies only to his chastisement of his people or of individuals, but nowhere of the judgment of his enemies, a point which makes it impossible to apply this verse to Assyria. The breaking of the Assyrian yoke is to be now. Suggesting that the event was not far distant when the tributary relation of Judah to Ashurbanipal, who was the king who took Manasseh away to Babylon, though he afterwards restored him, would come to an end. In verse 14, the change from the feminine applied to Judah to the masculine shows that the commandment concerns Nineveh and the Assyrians. Their gods are to be cut off, their line is to come to an end, they are to be buried, as Ezekiel declared, Asher is there in Sheol. His graves are about him, set in the sides of the pit. For the Assyrian is of small account, dishonored, or vile is the word used. We may imagine the tremendous declaration of faith contained in these words, delivered at the time when the Assyrian Empire was the greatest power on earth, and the rejoicing in Jerusalem as the messenger comes hastening over the mountains, no doubt of Israel, to bring the glad tidings of peace at last from the ruthless oppressor. The passage is apparently a quotation from Isaiah 52, and upon the basis of this deliverance, recognized as the work of the Lord who has made bare his holy arm. The prophet calls upon Judah to keep the feasts of the law and to perform the vows made in the time of distress. For the wicked counselor of the villainous one, a term of reproach for the Assyrian officers who passed through the land for the collection of tribute, shall be cut off. No doubt Nahum and his contemporaries hoped that the destruction of Nineveh would be the signal for the complete restoration of Israel to harmony with God. Yet the thoughtful ones must have wondered how such a blessing could be in view of two facts. First, the manifest corruption of the nation, which was not yet prepared for the blessing. And secondly, the clear indications in earlier prophecies that Judah was to be taken captive to Babylon, power which had not yet risen to international status. Standing at our vantage point, we perceive the great scope of this verse. The oppressions of Babylon, of Rome, and of the times of the Gentiles had all to pass before the peace, published by the messengers of the gospel of Christ, would bring lasting blessing to all Israel. Chapter 2. The first seven verses form a vivid picture of the besiegers and the besieged. He that dasheth in pieces, and the term means the disperser, the scatterer or devastator, is the besieger of Nineveh. Ironically, the Ninevites are urged to make all preparations for the defense. Fence thy defenses, strengthen thy might. For the Lord has a work in hand. He restoreth and bringeth again, and that's in the RV, the seed of Jacob, to whom he gave the name Israel. For the vine of Israel had been emptied by the emptiers. Their land had been plundered. As a result, the Lord would send his mighty men, the fierce Medians, and the Babylonians, who would unwittingly be carrying out his will, to bring about the downfall of Nineveh, just as later he commanded his sanctified ones, that is the Medes and Persians, to destroy Babylon. These valiant men have red shields, such as appear regularly on the Assyrian monuments. Their chariots flash with steel, the RV that is, the meaning of the phrase translated with flaming torches in the AV is uncertain. And they brandish their spears with shafts of fir. And the scene now moves to the inside of the besieged city. The chariots drive madly about the broadways. The Assyrian king remembers his mighty men. When summoned, they come stumbling, perhaps from wine, or the expression may just convey fear, to their places on the walls. And there they find the attackers have already prepared the mantelet, that is the covered shelter, used for the protection of the soldiers who are attacking the defences with battering rams. As the monuments illustrate so graphically, the gates of the river shall be opened. Nineveh was surrounded and guarded by the rivers Tigris, Kauser, and the greater Zab, the second of which actually ran through the city. And although there is no particular historical evidence on this point, it is obvious that the gates must have been a weak point in the defences. Indeed, tradition asserts that an inundation washed away the foundations of the walls. The palace was to be dissolved, since archaeologists have revealed that at least two of Nineveh's palaces were burnt. The sense is probably dissolved by fire. Hazab is an unknown word. In view of the allusion to her maids, it has been suggested that it is the name of the queen or a cryptic name for Nineveh, like Shishak for Babylon. But no certainty is possible. In any case, the women go forth almost certainly into captivity, moaning and beating upon their breasts. The inhabitants of Nineveh, multitudinous like a great pool of water, shall flee in panic, despite efforts to make a stand, and her despoilers shall strip her of her silver, gold, and pleasant furniture until she is empty, void, and waste, or as the Hebrew is said to sound, Buka, Kumbuka, Kumbulaka. Three words with the same basic sense, but in ascending order. The speaker's commentary suggests sacking, and ransacking. Her people show all the physical signs of distress, and the Lord now returns upon Nineveh the words of Sennacherib to Hezekiah. Where are now the gods of Arpad, that Yahweh should deliver you out of mine hand? By inquiring, where is now the dwelling place of lions? For the lion was conspicuous on the monuments of Assyria as a symbol of proud strength. Behold, I am against thee, saith Yahweh of hosts. The title occurs in Nahum only here, and at chapter 3 and verse 5. Micaiah had seen Yahweh sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing by him. His hosts are his angels, and the use of the title is a rebuke to the idolatrous worship of the host of heaven. As a result, Nineveh's chariots and swords should be burned, and no longer would her emissaries like Rabshakeh bear throughout the countries her imperial demands. The third chapter is a mingled lamentation, indictment, and description of Nineveh's overthrow. The crimes are lies, rapine, and the devouring of the prey like a lion. As Sargon, father of Sennacherib, boasts on the monuments, "I have ground to powder the nations. But the invading army shall come with their prancing horses and leaping chariots, their horsemen armed with sword and spear, and the city shall be filled with corpses. The witchcrafts and whoredoms of which Nineveh is accused are the efforts to force the subject peoples to worship Assyrian gods." See the words of Rabshakeh before the walls of Hezekiah's Jerusalem in Isaiah 36. And Rawlinson, in the speaker's commentary, comments upon the attempts to diffuse everywhere a knowledge and recognition of the gods of Assyria. And nothing is more universal than the practice of setting up in the subject countries the laws of Asher, or altars to the great gods. A similar charge is brought against Babylon by Isaiah in the 47th chapter. Assyria's selling of nations would then be an allusion to the transportation of whole communities to other lands, sometimes to be sold as slaves. But the Lord of hosts would expose the graceful harlot to ignominy. Her skirts would be lifted and thrown over her head in accordance with the practice with women convicted of unchastity. See Ezekiel 16 and Hosea 2, so that her shame might be witnessed by all nations. She shall be exposed in the pillory as a spectacle, and she shall find neither helpers nor comforters in the day of her desolation. In verses 8 to 10, that short section cites the case of Populus No. That is the great Egyptian city of Thebes, called No Ammon, because of the god Ammon worshipped there. Thebes had been the capital of Upper Egypt, and famous from antiquity for its splendor and military power. Its pharaohs, conquerors for six centuries, from 1700 to 1100 BC, had made it the center of a world empire, like a former Nineveh, in fact. Its palaces and temples were immense, as the ruins of Karnak and Luxor bear witness to this day. Its great temples, halls, colonnades, colossal statues, obelisks, sculptures were on a scale of imposing magnificence to which there is probably no parallel in the world, according to the Century Bible. The Great Hall of Karnak was 170 feet wide by 329 feet long, with 134 columns of colossal proportions supporting the roof, some of them 62 feet high and 35 feet in circumference. The pharaohs were gods. Their palaces were therefore temples in which the statues of the monarch were 10 times the size of the rest of his soldiers. And Thebes was situated upon the Nile streams, that is, among the rivers. The word is the plural of the usual word for the Nile. The sea was the Nile itself, which formed one of the city's defences, and in her strength she received the homage of Cush, that is Ethiopia, the people of South Egypt, as well as of Put, and the Lubim, inhabitants of North Africa. Yet, as Isaiah had prophesied in his 20th chapter, this great city had quite recently been brought to the dust through two Assyrian invasions of Egypt, when Ashurbanipal in 663 BC had completed its sack. Now, should Nineveh think herself worthy to escape a similar fate? Verse 11, Nineveh was to become drunken with a cup of the divine wrath. That is, as Jeremiah was to prophesy about Babylon and Isaiah had done of Jerusalem. She was to be hidden, that is, obscure, after her centuries of glory. A prophecy which was accomplished through the sands of the desert. The stronghold should collapse like figs shaken off the tree when they are ripe. But people should be as women. A not unfamiliar image for weakness and fear used of the Egyptians in Jeremiah 50 and of the Chaldeans in 51. The mountain passes, that is, the gates of the land, would be undefended, and the bars of their city gate should be burned with fire. During the 2-year siege which they were to endure, the Ninevites are ironically urged to make every effort in their own defense. They should draw water and make plenty of bricks to repair the damaged ramparts, but in the very place where they make these preparations, the Ninevites should be slain with a sword. Devoured by the locust, that is the canker worm, according to Joel chapter 1 and chapter 2, and ravaged by fire. Despite the multitude of their merchants and of their crowned officers and captains, on the Assyrian monuments, the high officers wear diadems resembling the lower band of the royal mitre. A fact which may throw some light on the words of Isaiah in chapter 10 at verse 8, are not my princes altogether kings? The word translated captains is not of Hebrew origin and is found elsewhere only in Jeremiah 51. Being probably the Assyrian name of a high-ranking officer. As the locusts grow dormant in the cold, but disperse rapidly as soon as the warmth of the sun reaches them, so these mighty men of Assyria shall vanish. The king of Assyria now addressed directly his nobles and his... The king of Assyria is now addressed directly. His nobles and his governors slumber, while his people are scattered over the mountains like a flock without a shepherd. His bruise, that is a grievous bodily injury, and his wound, which is often used of plagues inflicted by God, are both beyond healing. All who hear the tidings of his fall break into rejoicing, for upon all the nations his wickedness, his extortion and cruelty has been a continual burden. So Nahum's burden of Nineveh comes to an end. Not many years later, about 612 BC, according to the Babylonian Chronicle, the Medes, the Babylonians, and the Scythians besieged the city. And upon its fall, the Medes thoroughly sacked it, and the long era of its desolation began. Today, the site of Nineveh is formed by uninhabited mounds, the province of the excavators whose spades have revealed the former glory of the ancient capital of Assyria. Compared with most of the other prophecies, Nahum's work is of limited scope, but a knowledge of the tremendous part played in the affairs of the Middle Eastern nations for more than two centuries by the Empire of Assyria and of the sheer misery and suffering which it inflicted upon its subject people should enable us to imagine the immense sense of relief and joy that the news of its fall would produce. To a prophet of one of the smallest of those nations, Nahum of Israel was granted the rare privilege of announcing that fall in advance in the name of Yahweh, whom the Assyrian had despised. To the ignorant heathen, the fall of Nineveh was just one of those political adjustments which are the result of natural causes. Assyria was vanquished because her enemies were now too strong for her. But to the faithful in Israel, it was the work of God. For had he not told it in advance through the mouth of a true prophet, as he had promised his people he would do through Moses? The affairs of Judah were desperate. The knowledge of God was little found in the land, but evidently the Lord had not abandoned his people, and the heathen would not triumph forever. The time of peace would come when Judah should keep the law of God once more and pay her vows. As we look back over the centuries, we can see the judgment of corrupt Nineveh as the type of God's final controversy with the nations, when their power shall be subdued and his name shall be glorified in all the earth. And so came the judgment of God only a few years later upon rebellious Judah by means of the Babylonians. And so it came less than a century later upon proud Babylon itself, and six centuries after that upon the city of the Israel that rejected the Lord. And so will it come again upon all powers that resist the coming of the Lord